This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we debate the price we pay for so-called free internet services like Gmail and Facebook. I'll give you a hint. It's your privacy. But first, one of the big topics of debate for the Federal Communications Commission is the idea of net neutrality, the idea that all content on the internet should be treated equally by providers. After a long debate and public comments, the FCC passed rules to enforce net neutrality back in 2015. Ajit Pai, the newly appointed FCC chairman, has a different viewpoint when it comes to net neutrality.
I've long said that net neutrality is a solution in search of a problem. I mean, there are all these different broadband policies we could be focusing on to bring greater competition to the American marketplace, which ironically would solve the very problem that net neutrality advocates purport to care about.
So what policies might the FCC focus on? What might these policies mean for you if you want to stream video from an app as opposed to, say, let's say, your cable box? And will other telecom issues like broadband expansion be regulated? Well, we wanted to know the answers to these. We invited Ajit Pai onto our program, and we were told he was unavailable. But my next guests are here. Susan Crawford is a law professor and co-director of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. John Brodkin is senior IT reporter for Ars Technica. He's based out of Marlboro, Massachusetts, and joins us via Skype. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, thanks.
Hello.
It's good to have you. Susan, can you give us a brief explanation of what net neutrality is and how it was looked at by 2015?
Yeah, well, basically about 10 years ago, the FCC said they wouldn't have any legal authority over high-speed internet access providers. People wanted to make sure that those providers treated content trying to reach subscribers equally, and the FCC wanted to make sure it had legal authority over those providers. So back in 2015, the FCC essentially relabeled high-speed internet access as a utility and along the way adopted some rules about how providers should treat content.
Mm-hmm. And those rules basically said there's no no priority for traffic?
No throttling, no blocking. But really the most important move was just to say we have legal authority. And it's that Ajit Pai wants to get rid of, even more than the rules. He wants to make sure that these carriers can basically do whatever they want.
Is that what he basically said in the little bit of clip that we played?
Well, he's not saying that directly. He said that elsewhere. In that little clip, he's saying, I think net neutrality doesn't really exist as a problem. What does exist as a problem is a stagnant, uncompetitive market completely controlled by a series of local monopolies in the United States, which is posing huge problems for the country's destiny. And that he's not willing to comment on.
He's not. John, part of the FCC's net neutrality rules was to reclassify the internet as a utility, like how the phone companies work, Title II classification that Susan was talking about. Pai has said I favor an open internet and I oppose Title II. Does that mean that it is, unregulated?
I mean, it's hard to say. I don't think unregulated entirely is what he wants, but he wants to eliminate the Title II classification, which in general requires internet providers to be just and reasonable in their practices and rates. And by getting rid of that, that would also get rid of the net neutrality rules. In general, he said that he thinks internet service providers should be unfettered by regulation, so they can spend their time or money in investing their networks instead of following rules. When he says he wants an open internet, he hasn't actually said if he would support any type of net neutrality rules. So it kind of seems like he just wants the internet providers to be free from regulation, and in that sense, he thinks that will create a lot of competition that will, preserve the open internet.
But in allowing everybody to be the wild west of providers and in sort of competition, which people like, would that not force out smaller providers who may not have as many customers in their database?
I'm not sure about that. I think the biggest issue is trying to make it economically viable for smaller providers to compete against the big ones. I don't know if getting rid of net neutrality prevents that, but it's almost like a separate issue. Actually, I think, Chairman Pai made one good point that if you had a lot of competition, you wouldn't necessarily need net neutrality rules because then the marketplace would decide. But right now, most people only have at most one choice of high-speed broadband provider. So if they could do something that would actually improve competition in cities and towns, then, you know, that would be a big improvement, even if they at the same time got rid of net neutrality rules. But it's not really clear how they would achieve that.
Susan, what's your comment on this?
Yeah, I agree with John. Actually, it's clear that PI wants to get rid of Title II labeling, which would essentially get rid of any legal authority over high-speed Internet access providers, because twice courts found that the FCC trying to reach them using other parts of the Telecommunications Act wouldn't work, wouldn't stand. And so what we're going to be left with is this series of local monopolies. And PI seems very happy to just let that sit. He's saying we'll see more competition. It's extremely unlikely we have a very broken marketplace in the United States. And absent government intervention, there's no reason that would change. There's no real competition to the local cable actor in most American places.
Yeah, I know in my town I can only get one, possibly two, cable providers. Others are kept out.
That's right. Even though that's been illegal for a couple of decades now, as a matter of fact, in every town it's usually one big monopoly provider, and that's it. So they're not under any pressure from either competition or oversight to upgrade networks to fiber, to lower prices. Look, they're not acting nefariously. It's just not in their interest to invest to support economic growth and social justice, which is what we need from infrastructure. Most other infrastructure in America is not controlled by private parties.
Mm-hmm. The FCC has recently expanded the Lifeline program, which gives subsidies to low-income families for phone and broadband services. And PI reversed that, John. What is the reason for that?
Well, he's concerned about fraud and waste in the program, and he doesn't want any expansion until the FCC comes up with a more expansive system to prevent Internet providers from illicitly gaining subsidies that they're not supposed to get. So what happened was there were nine providers that were approved under a new program that lets them offer subsidized broadband throughout the country. And instead of going through a more cumbersome process where they have to apply to each state to offer services in that state, so for now those nine companies can't offer the subsidized service. And in the FCC order, you know, they said that customers of the one company of those nine that's already offering the subsidized service, they can try to find another provider, but at the same time, the FCC acknowledged that some of these poor people will have to pay $9.25 more a month, you know, if they can't find an alternative provider.
Mm-hmm. There was also a proposal to open up cable boxes to companies so that they could create apps or other alternatives. I mean, everybody is now, the big thing is now to stream video. And where, you know, what do we think the new regulations or the new FCC chairman is going to do about allowing people to stream video from either their cable box or their app from where they would like to?
Well, he doesn't really have any plans to do anything about that. He thinks the market will just take care of it. And there are cable companies that are offering their programming via apps on set-top boxes. What the old proposal under the Democrats would have done would have been to require every company like Comcast and Verizon and AT&T to make apps for something like the Apple TV or the Roku so that instead of renting a cable box each month, you could just watch on you know, one of your other devices. So that proposal is what PI has pulled off the table, and he hasn't pushed any sort of alternative.
Susan, the FCC recently stopped an investigation into a practice called zero rating. Can you explain what zero rating means and how it affects net neutrality?
Sure. The idea would be that someone like AT&T could treat content with which it has some kind of relationship, like maybe it owns content or has a special contract with a content provider, could treat that content differently and not have it count against data caps that their subscribers are otherwise subject to. This is a different flavor of net neutrality, and the prior FCC said that AT&T's sponsored data plan, which is that zero rating kind of plan, looked like it was not lawful under the existing open Internet rules. They did that in a report issued right before the PI FCC came in, and PI has now pulled that report off the table. along with a report saying that investment in infrastructure by a government is a really good idea. So he's sweeping aside recommendations that the Obama FCC made because he doesn't see them in line with the interests of these carriers.
Well, I'm a little confused because you said it's illegal for cities to offer only one internet service, and I hear what people are saying. If really we had done away with monopolies, then net neutrality would actually be able to work a little bit by competition. Why are cities allowed to do this then if it's illegal?
There are a few issues there. What's happened is that where it's possible to consolidate, competition is impossible. So these carriers have divided up the country among themselves, and that's why where you are, you might only be able to get Time Warner or now Spectrum, and I might only be able to get Comcast. So there might be a number of providers in the nation, but where you sit, you'll likely have just one. Cities are able to offer, in most states of the union, things like dark fiber passive infrastructure that anybody could use to provide essentially a public option to those carriers' services for internet access. PI is interested in just helping the existing carriers do whatever they want, and that's what we're going to be seeing out of this FCC.
I could just add thing here. It's illegal for a city to give a cable company an exclusive contract and say no one else can come in, but that doesn't mean that there has to be multiple companies. You know, ultimately, it's the decision of private providers as to whether it's worth going into a city or a town. And what happens is you end up with de facto monopolies, not legal monopolies, because once Comcast controls the customers in a city or town, it's just not financially feasible for another provider to come in.
Okay. Susan Crawford, law professor at Harvard, and John Brodkin, senior IT reporter at Ars Technica. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, how much personal data are you willing to share in exchange for services like Gmail and Facebook, and where do you draw the line on privacy on the internet? Give us a call, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk, or tweet us at SciFry. We'll be back talking about privacy after this break, so stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Facebook now has 1.2 billion daily users. Are you one of them? If so, what do you think the social media giant knows about you? I checked on it this morning in the ad preferences panel. I've looked up my own Facebook account and found that Facebook has pigeonholed me in the following categories. One, that I like people who primarily use a 4G connection. I don't know how or why that's important, but that's what they decided. I like people whose birthdays are in the month of March. Wow, surprise, surprise again. And this one really was surprising. I prefer roommates, people who room with each other, than to people who live with family members. Okay, you know everything you need to know about, you know, I don't even remember telling Facebook that I have roommates. And in fact, I don't have any, so this, I guess, is the price we pay for all these free services, isn't it? You pay with your privacy and what they think your life is about. Our friends over at WNYC's Note to Self podcast have been exploring some of those trade-offs, what our smartphones track, how algorithms sell us stuff, and how to claw back a little personal space. It's their latest project, The Privacy Paradox. The host and managing editor of Note to Self, Manoj Zomorodi, is here to share what they found. Welcome back, Manoj.
It's great to be here, Ira. Thanks for having me.
And if you want to hear what you think, and we do want to hear what you think, I like to give out much of our privacy. Do you want to give it out? I don't give mine out. You can give us a call at 844-724-8255. That's 844-SciTalk, or tweet us at SciFry. This is, Manoj, this is sort of latest boot camp from Note to Self?
Yeah, that's right. This is our third year in a row that we've done something interactive with tens of thousands of our listeners. And this time around, Ira, we wanted to take on this idea, this big, vast idea of digital privacy, because we spend so much time online these days, and it seems as though our civil rights don't necessarily extend to the virtual world where we live a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. And you developed a quiz, a privacy personalized personality quiz to gauge what people are comfortable with in terms of sharing data, So what type of privacy personality are you?
Well, interesting that you ask. Before we did the project and I took the quiz, I was a realist because I felt I answered all these questions. I kind of understood that for a service to be really personalized, I have to give up some of my information, my personal information, my data, so that the service does what I want it to, so that Twitter knows who I want to see next, right? But after having done this five-part plan, the privacy paradox, I have to say I have come around and my score went up. I am now a believer. And a believer. I actually went to the National Archives and I went to see the Fourth Amendment. It actually wasn't the Fourth Amendment originally. But in any case, this idea that our right to privacy is actually something incredibly innate and written into the Founding Fathers' doctrine as to how we want to live. And I think I came up with the idea of the project before the latest administration came into office. But now, as we talk about more marginalized populations being concerned about being targeted for their beliefs, their affiliations, or their origins, more and more this idea of privacy, it's less ephemeral and more sort of real, very real.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to play a clip, an experience of one of your listeners, an experience that they shared with you. And this listener wanted to remain anonymous, so this isn't her real voice. But it's really a powerful example of internet ad targeting gone wrong. Let's hear that.
I felt recently that I've had some problems with drinking a little bit more than I should. I don't know if it's a huge problem, but this morning I was actually just kind of Googling to see what my options were and if I could talk to someone. And then I logged into Facebook, and the first ad that I saw was for my local liquor store. And there's just something so inherently offensive in that I don't even really know how to react to that. I mean, it wasn't like I was getting ads for therapy or something helpful. You know, they just took this information that was so shameful and exploited it.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, Ira, to me, we did a call out to our listeners, sort of tell us your stories about privacy. And there were, of course, some people who told us sort of the classic stories that their social security number was stolen or they were hacked in some way. Other people said, you know, it hasn't happened yet. I feel a little creepy about my data being out there, but nothing has happened. But then we had all these stories in the middle, this idea of personal privacy being stepped on. Another guy married into a very religious family. Facebook changed its privacy settings and revealed that he was part of an atheist group to his wife, who subsequently divorced him.
Wow.
All kinds of stories where you think, well, now that you share your ideas, your most intimate thoughts with the web, it doesn't get protected there. Right now, the Fourth Amendment only covers what happens in your home. Well, our home is now virtual. Yeah, it is online.
I know that one of your episodes in the series focused on a project at ProPublica all about algorithms and machine bias, what they know about us and what they do with all that information. So I want to bring on another guest to talk about that. Eric Umansky is Deputy Managing Editor at ProPublica here in New York, and he joins us here in our New York studios. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome. You've done a lot of work investigating how algorithms can discriminate, and one of the really shocking things you all uncovered was how Facebook was allowing advertisers to specifically exclude specific racial groups from seeing certain ads. Tell us about that.
Sure. So. Facebook is, you know, if you look at the underpinnings of what Facebook does and what it serves, you know, it's great for showing photos of family and kids and newborns and your, of course, wonderful vacations that never go wrong. But what, in fact, it is also doing, its whole purpose really as a business is to gather information about you as a user, and then to offer that very detailed information to advertisers so that they can do what's called micro-targeting, right? If you're an advertiser, you really only want to advertise to the people who are most likely to buy your product because that's most efficient. And that is something that Facebook can do with the wealth of data that it has about users in a way that, you know, network TV cannot come close to.
But they would argue, you know, you're going to get ads. Mm-hmm. You know, that's our business. You're going to get ads. So why not just give you ads of stuff that you're interested in?
Sure. So that actually can be a very powerful tool. It can be very helpful.
But you're saying that they leave stuff out.
Right. So the question, of course, is always with tools that can be helpful. Well, it's a powerful tool. And what is the tool used for? And what are the possible uses of the tool? And what are the protections to make sure it's not abused? So in this case, Facebook was offering to advertisers, you have your little pull-down menu. I want only people from Portland who like medium roast coffee and so on and so forth. And, you know, a logical extension, if you're an engineer, if you're a software coder and you think, well, you know, I'm going to include a menu that says here are things, right? It's just like a search on the web. You can say here are things I want to include in the search and here are things I want to exclude. And so it's a logical thing. It says you can exclude all sorts of things. And on the pull-down menu is exclude ethnic affinities for people with, quote-unquote, affinities to African-Americans, mm-hmm. people with affinities, quote-unquote, to Hispanics. Interestingly, there was no pull-down menu for people with ethnic affinities to whites, which is sort of a telling thing mm-hmm. about the values. You know, you think of these as all zeros and ones. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's how the coders think about it. But of course, there are values involved. And I am sure that people at Facebook and the coders at Facebook thought, well, this is all perfectly logical. This is the tool that we are giving. When we learned about that, we thought, well, it feels like other people should know that. And there are some real serious questions there. And you can tell by the response to it, which was really significant. Yeah. You know, we weren't the only ones who thought that.
Manoush?
Yeah, I mean, I love ProPublica's work. And so that was our thing on day two, is we told people about this targeting, this ethnic affinity targeting. And what I also love that ProPublica did is they tested it. They bought an ad for an event for housing, and a housing event. And they specifically left out people who had certain ethnic affinities. And from what I understand, you know, Julia Angwin, the investigative reporter who works with Eric, they bought the ad, no problem, and then went to a civil rights lawyer who said that is absolutely illegal. It is discrimination.
I believe he gasped.
How did this end? Did it have a happy ending at all?
So what happened is, and one of the contexts here is, of course, you know, and let's understand both the kind of positive targeting that can happen and the negative targeting that can happen. You know, there is certainly nothing wrong with somebody putting an ad on a certain TV station because they think, those people might like the ad. Our government and our society has created rules in, the past 45 or 50 years to protect certain classes for certain things. So there is a long history of racial discrimination in housing, long history of racial discrimination in hiring. And so our government during the civil rights era made laws that said you can't discriminate on the basis of, for example, race when it comes to housing. So that's why when Manoush says we decided to test this tool, and not to only say it as a hypothetical, but to do a housing-related ad, and we put it in, right, not simply because it raises ethical questions, but it raises legal questions. And what happened? Well, what happened was, first, the ad was approved in 15 minutes, and then in what was, I think, a very unsurprising development, we published our story and there was a wave of criticism from the Congressional Black Caucus, from actually the federal government, from many places. And Facebook, in a short period of time, announced that they were going to put protections in place to make sure this wouldn't happen.
Interesting. Manoush, in your series, you talked to Sir Tim Berners-Lee, who is considered the inventor of the World Wide Web, about a project he's working on called SOLID, a new way to store personal data on the web. We have a clip here in which he lays out his vision for how data should be treated.
I own all my data. I can have direct access to it. Anything that you, as a company, as a bank or a supermarket, anything you keep about me, I can access at any point. And if it's personal data, I can fix it. I can, if they spelled my name wrong or they've got my blood type wrong, then I can fix it. So in the future, I'll tell the bank, by the way, this is where my data lives. Every time a bank statement comes up, I'm going to give you a key so you can put it in there, and I'll trust you. And in fact, I require you anything in the relationship between us, every wire transfer, every change of terms of service. From your point, you have to put in here. And that information, if I want to give access to anybody else, then that's up to me.
Is that the future, you think?
Well, that's what Sir Tim wants it to be. So that clip that you just played was actually from day number 5 of the Privacy Paradox. And on that day, I had the pleasure of going to visit him at his MIT lab. And we sort of talked long and short term. In the long term, he thinks that the web that he built has been corroded, essentially, that it has a social problem, as he calls it, where we don't have any transparency. We have no control over our data. Mm-hmm. So what he really wants is a paradigm shift where instead of me logging into Facebook, Facebook would log into me and I would decide how much data I would give them and I would be able to take it back. Now, is that going to happen immediately? No, that's a big, tall order. But I mean, Ira, if there's anyone who can do it, it's the guy who invented the web in the first place, right?
Right. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. We're talking about data and privacy. You know, I was listening to what he said, and what struck me is, well, if they want this data so much, why don't they pay us for the data?
You know,
I was hoping that. Why don't they pay us for the data? They're going to use it. They make all kinds of money from it. Here we say, well, we're so lucky to have it for free. No, we should get being paid for it. Well, what do you think, Eric?
Well, I actually think we are paying for it, right? And we are paying for it because, you know, they are paying us in in-kind ways, right? So we give Facebook our data. And in turn, we get these really handy tools to keep track of what's going on with our friends and what movies we should go see and so forth. The real question there is that transaction transparent or not? Mm. Right? And too often it isn't. I mean, I was listening to Tim Berners-Lee and thinking about how far it is away from the world we are in now. I mean, one of the stories that we did around Facebook as well is we pointed out that, you know, so you looked up your information, Ira, right? And you found, well, you know, gee, they think I like roommates. I don't really like roommates, right? And but it turns out that's the information that Facebook is telling you it has about you. Mm. It's actually not all the information it has about you.
Oh, I see.
One of the things they are not showing you on that page, fundamentally, is that Facebook buys information about users from third-party brokers, in particular, brokers, information brokers who gather often financial information about your life, size of your mortgage, how many of your cars, your housing, and on your credit score. And they put it all together, and that is Ira Flatow, not just that he likes 4G, not just that he, you know, does or does not like roommates. The problem is they're not telling you about that.
Yeah. Wow. This is all interesting stuff. Do you think we can take back any of our privacy here? How do we do that?
Yeah, so that's what we tried to do with our series. This is a 5-part plan, and we try to take this sometimes terrifying, very overwhelming topic and break it down into small parts because that's the only way I can wrap my head around it. So, for example, day one, Bruce Schneier, the cryptographer, who I think has been on Science Friday, he talks us through, you know, something that a lot of us know we should do, but we don't, and we never make the time, digging through the settings of all the apps on our phone.
Yes.
Very simple things. So like one listener told me, he went through and he found out that this flashlight app was collecting his contacts and his location and had access to his microphone. Okay, simple thing. Microphone app or flashlight app, be gone. You know, something very, very simple that we can do. And I think we have to start at a very small points to sort of understand what it feels like to take back a little bit of our privacy. And then maybe we can start to look into the future about how we do something more systemically.
But you hope people are skilled enough to be able to go through all the menus and menus and menus you have to on the cell phones to do that.
Well, I think one of the challenges there is that there is a massive power disparity, right? The companies, I mean, Facebook, the tool that we built with you guys and that we did on the project with Note to Self, you know, it actually, what we did was, and the thing you used, Ira, allows people to find at least what Facebook is telling them they know about them, which actually people could find anyway. It is on Facebook's site. It's just buried and buried and buried. And so, you know, one of the things that journalism can do and other outfits can do is take a little bit of this power back.
Yes, right? Exactly.
And we, hopefully after people listen today, they will get a little bit more power back. And we have a link today to the Privacy Paradox and the ProPublica series. It's at sciencefriday.com/privacy.
Come do it with us. It's fun, too. We try to make it fun.
There you go. Manoush Zomorodi and Eric Umansky, thank you both for taking time to be with us
today.
Thank you, Eric.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about The Expanse, this new sci-fi movie out that tries to actually portray space a little bit more realistically. We'll be back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Pop quiz. If you're on a spaceship traveling to the asteroid belt and you need to change course, no big deal, right? You just turn your little steering wheel and your ship turns. Well, that may be the case for something like Star Trek, but in sci-fi's The Expanse, it's a bit more dramatic.
If we flip right now and burn like hell, I can get us within 50,000 clicks.
Oh, great. Then we'll all be puking in our crash couches while the cargo busts loose and scuttles the ship.
Make sure that ice stays put.
This is Holden. We've logged a distress call near CA-221-6862.
We're obliged to change our course and respond. Make sure your acceleration drug dispensers are full. This will be a high G maneuver. Prepare for flip and burn.
Acceleration drug dispensers. You don't hear that anywhere else, and The Expanse has it. It takes place in the early days of our hypothetical voyage to the solar system. In the sci-fi thriller, we have colonized Mars, we're mining the asteroid belt for ice and minerals, and we don't have artificial gravity or instantaneous communication or even world peace like we might have in other science fiction films. It's imperfect, it's more realistic, and it's based on science. And we're going to talk about it now with two of the minds that helped bring it to us and help bring The Expanse to life. And if you haven't been watching season two, by the way, be ready for some spoilers, but it's worth it. It'll be worth it. My guests are Niran Shankar, executive producer and showrunner for The Expanse. He also has a PhD in applied physics and electrical engineering, and Ty Frank, producer for the show and co-author of the book series it's based on, Orbit Books. And if you're a fan of how the future is envisioned in The Expanse, you have questions for us. Our number is 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK, or you can tweet us at SciFry. Gentlemen, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. Hi.
Hey there. Ty, as author of the book, set the scene for our listeners who haven't seen this show. We've colonized Mars. We're mining the asteroid belts. One thing that's interesting is that we don't know what year this is happening in, and I imagine you've done that on purpose.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely deliberate. The minute you put a year on things, people start counting backwards and figuring out when all the various things would have had to happen to set that up. And the other thing that they do is they go and they find their astronomy app and they figure out the relative positions of all the solar system bodies at the date you claim things are happening, and then they start doing the math to see if your ship travel times are right.
People are that geeky about this stuff.
Oh, yeah. They are.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what the clip that we heard, Noreen. In the very first episode of the show, we see one of the implications of the real physics, a spaceship that has to essentially flip over to change course. I mean, and I've never seen navigation like this so dramatic on TV or so realistic.
Well, you know, it's one of those things that's happened when you see so much science fiction and television and movies, is everything's, I think, traditionally was modeled over, World War II fighter engagements in the Pacific. And so everybody thinks that spacecrafts, change direction like planes do. In reality, of course, a rocket only works in one direction. So if you're speeding up one way, in order to slow down, you've got to point the rocket in the other direction. And I think there was The Expanse was probably the first time that anybody made an action sequence out of a ship just making a turn.
Mm-hmm. And Ty, why can't we have in our spaceships artificial gravity or warp speed like we do on the other shows?
Well, in the books, it was a conscious decision not to do those things because we wanted to have that sort of realistic near future feel. And one of the things that always bugged me on other shows is they'd have artificial gravity, and the only thing anyone ever uses that for is so that they can walk around in their spaceships. Whereas if you have the ability to create gravity fields out of nothing, that is literally a humanity-changing technology that should have effects on everything you do. But somehow it seems to never show up anywhere else except for people to walk around in their spaceships.
I like some of the, you know, there are a lot of little visual Easter eggs, so to speak, in the show, like the small bird that's flying on Ceres only needs to flap its wings once or twice because the gravity is so weird. And what's really interesting, and I see there was a close-up on this so that we would notice this, is that when one of the characters is pouring himself a drink or a cup of coffee, it doesn't take a smooth flow down. It takes a little circuitous route to get to the cup.
Well, I think it's one of the first science fiction shows that's bothered to make a little moment out of the Coriolis effect. And that was a consequence of the spin gravity of Ceres Station, where that thing was set. It's details like that that I think that a lot of the fans of the show really embraced. And Ty and Daniel put them in the book, the Scotch deflection in there. And it's one of those nice things that you see over and over again in the show.
Mm-hmm. And you've described space as being a character in this show. Tell us what you mean by that.
It was one of the things that attracted me to the books initially was, you know, that this was an opportunity. As Ty was saying, it's like, you know, every other science fiction show uses gravity so that people can walk around in their ships like they're on, you know, on Earth. Here was an opportunity to have people, you know, living in an environment where unless they were under thrust, you know, they didn't, you know, when there was no thrust, there was no weight. That space is a terribly inhospitable environment to life. And the issues of air and water and just protection from that environment are constantly an issue in the show. Most science fiction avoids it because it's difficult physically to produce people being weightless, for example. The Expanse embraced it, and we've used it over and over again to as much dramatic effect as we possibly can, and we're going to continue to do that.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that bothers me a lot about a lot of the science fiction movies that I see out, whether it's Alien or your program, is we're still shooting torpedoes and chunks of metal at each other as a bullet. Well, when does lasers happen? You know, why are we still doing that stuff? Why are we shooting people with a ray gun?
Well, lasers are handy for some things, but they're very easy to deflect. They're very easy to diffuse and rob of energy, whereas a chunk of tungsten traveling at 1 or 2% of the speed of light, there's nothing you can do about that. There is no version of a shield for that. Where a laser could be deflected by just spraying out a high albedo gas and diffracting the laser away. If you put gas between you and a railgun round, it still goes right through you.
Mm-hmm. And spoiler alert coming up about seasons two, which I love season two. It's great. Is that you have scientists now who have been their consciousness, their has been taken away from them, their ideas of humanity and who they are, and all they do is care about themselves and their experiments. Is that a fair way to treat scientists? Is that saying this is how the best scientists are?
I think that was a way to create scientists who were lacking in empathy so that they could make an experiment happen, a brutal experiment happen on 100,000 people and just sit there and collect the data and not feel anything for them.
Yeah, my writing partner, Daniel Abraham, often says that just because something is real doesn't mean it's believable as fiction. So you know, we all know that there have been examples of scientists doing really terrible things to other humans in our past. But when you write down that a bunch of scientists can do an experiment that kills 100,000 people, it feels unbelievable. People don't want to believe humans can do that to each other, so we had to give them an excuse. We had to give them a reason why they would allow that to happen that felt believable to a reader, even though in reality we humans have done that to each other over and over again.
You know, I think that as I listen to the dialogue, I pick out names of real people in it. Or am I just imagining that? Because the one Guy Molinari who's in there was actually from Staten Island. You know, it was the whole families. Is that, you're laughing. Is that done on purpose?
Yeah, so again, this is Daniel Abraham, my writing partner. He used to live in New York, and he took the Guy Molinari ferry to work every day. So that was the ferry he rode to work every day. So he named the ship after the ferry.
That was the famous one that I think hit the dock, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that was famous. That was a famous member of the Molinari family. That's interesting. So I'm not making this stuff up as I hear it. Then are there other names in there? I thought I had heard maybe a baseball player or something.
Well, I'm sure we probably have pulled a few names we know into there.
All right, let's go to the phones. 844-724-8255. Let's go to Anthony in Oklahoma. Hi, Anthony.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I had a question for you. I was going to see what do you guys think that the fuel would be used in the future as far as your show is concerned? Would we still be using like a solid state fuel like we're using for our rockets now? Or would we move on to something like nuclear or antimatter?
Well, our ships use fusion drives. So they use a fusible pellet as their energy propulsion material.
Hmm. And that's great. And you know what you don't use? Thanks for calling. What you don't also use in the show? What I don't see very much for, and that we would all think would be a progression, are robots, artificial intelligence, something like HAL or Data. The characters are not talking to the wall, waiting for the robot, you know, or the computer to listen to them.
Well, they're there. I mean, it's just that the focus of the show is about the character drama and the geopolitics and a million other things that are going on. Technology is there, but we oftentimes don't focus on it directly. We're not like a techno-porn kind of a show where we kind of glory and you know, indulge ourselves in gadgetry. Mark Fergus, who co-wrote the pilot with his writing partner, Hawk Osby, likes to say, you know, when you get into a car, you don't sit down and say, oh, my God, what a fabulous internal combustion engine this vehicle has. It's you just drive it. And so that's how we sort of approach it. And Ty and Daniel have always said, it's like, we ask the question in the writer's room. It's like, where are all the robots? Where's all the AIs? And they go, oh, they're there. You just, I mean, yeah. How do you think that ship, you know, maneuvers around in a particular way? It's like, but we just don't focus on them.
Right. Let's go to the phones to Chad in Houston, Texas. Hi, Chad.
Hey, I'm a huge fan of Science Friday, and I'm a big fan of the book. Well, the part of the book that I've read, I've caught bits and pieces, and honestly, I want to get a chance to watch it, you know, in full. But what really struck me about it is kind of what you were saying, actually, with the technology was the it was kind of almost mundane. Like, you know, to us, this is like they're shooting around in space, and it's just, you know, you got to take, you know, your acceleration drugs, you got to prepare for everything. And this looks so cool. But to them, it's like, I got to clock in. You know, you never see someone on the Enterprise like, I got to report for my ship. You know, it's always really great. And I felt like that was a really great and much more realistic depiction of what space exploration would be like. And I was wondering if that was intentional, but it sounds like it to a lot of extent was.
Yeah, it's definitely intentional. Daniel and I will often use the movie Alien as one of our biggest references and influences on the show. And the two characters in there, Parker and Brett, in the movie Alien, they're just janitors. They're just mechanics. The fact that they fly on a gigantic mining ship through space is irrelevant. Their job is fixing leaky pipes and wiring, and they complain about how many shares they get of the bonus. Yeah. We wanted to write about those two guys.
That was done very well. This is Science Writer from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about the sci-fi, that's the Sci-Fi Channel, SYFY, The Expanse, with Naren Shankar and Ty Frank. Any hint you can give us about where this is going at all? I mean, there's this spooky growing thing that we at this point think is alive, but not quite sure. And we're not quite sure if there's aliens involved in this thing.
Well, it sounds like we've got you exactly where we want.
you do. I mean, it's a complicated
thing. When we started in our writer's room, we had lots of questions for Ty and Daniel about where this thing was going, and I had only read like the first book at that point. It's never quite what you expect it to be, but as you go through the show, I think you'll see that there is a logic to what's happening with it. Just it may not be entirely apparent what exactly it's doing at this point. Mm-hmm.
Narain, you got your start on the Star Trek Next Generation series. Do audiences want more science than they used to?
You know, that's a good question. On Star Trek, it was less about actual science than it was about the sort of the fake futuristic science of the Star Trek universe. I think, you know, nowadays, one of the things that I see people responding to on The Expanse is, I think one of the callers had mentioned it, was it feels more realistic. It feels like this is the way it could actually be. Because we have adopted into the narrative everything that Ty and Daniel put in the books about the hostility of the environment, the way the difficulty of getting from place to place, the vast scale that you actually have to traverse to get from one planet to another. You know, and I think that in aggregate, that makes everything feel like, wow, maybe it could actually end up like this.
What I was looking forward to, I haven't seen much of the effort to terraform Mars yet. Have you figured out how that might work? I mean, I know one of the characters says, I thought I was going to see this in my lifetime, but I'm not anymore. Well, I'm hoping, maybe.
I know Ty has figured out how to terraform Mars.
you need a lot of water. They've been sort of strip mining the inner solar system of water sources and carting it all back to Mars for a while.
Well, it's a lot of fun. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us. And Narain Shankar is executive producer for the Sci-Fi Channel, The Expanse. Ty Frank is a producer for the show and co-author of the book series it's based on. Thank you for this series. Thank you for taking time to talk about it with us. Maybe we'll have
you
back.
Our pleasure. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. One last thing before we go. We're still talking a little bit about outer space. Have you ever heard of alien soil? It appears as worm-like patterns that glow in UV light. And the best part, no spaceship is required. You can find it anywhere that's dark and wet and underground, even your own basement. Whoa, I'm going down there tonight. Go to sciencefriday.com/alien soil to find out more. sciencefriday.com/alien soil. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks, as always, to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. We're talking about this stuff all week on our website at sciencefriday.com, also on our Facebook page and tweeting, all about the stuff that you like to talk about. So we'll see you during the week. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.